From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Michael Williams, CBS Radio News contributor. Our moderator is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, David Rennie.
Good day, everyone. And here are the issues. The Trump administration unveiled a strikingly bleak national security strategy, pledging to confront China and Russia, and arguing that previous American governments have been wrong to think that rising powers can be brought into a rules-based international order. In South Africa, the ruling African National Congress chose a new leader, Cyril Ramaphosa, a reformer sworn to tackle rampant corruption. In Chile, a conservative billionaire, Sebastian Piñera, won a resounding victory in a presidential election, in the latest example of Latin American voters tacking to the right. And in Washington, a major set of tax cuts passed Congress, handing a big win to Donald Trump and Republicans. Democrats called it a giveaway to the rich. So let's start with the national security strategy. Laura, the law forces all administrations to produce one of these things. It's sort of the highest level vision of the president's worldview. And they're often full of platitudes about strength and cooperation and leadership and all those things. But some of these strategies, you can look back and say that actually marked something of a kind of signal that turned out to have some lingering importance. Is there a sense that this first Donald Trump national security strategy was worth reading, that there was something of a signal in there as to the way that he views the world?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, there were all sorts of signals in there about how he views the world. Then again, those signals had come long before this national security strategy was released. And in many ways, the document was a reflection of what Trump has said as a campaigner. And there were some important differences, but a lot of what he was putting forward in terms of a focus on economics, skepticism of free trade, America first point of view, rejection of serious concern over climate change, all of those things, the writing has long been on the wall for. So, in fact, it was a provocative document, but that's because we have a provocative president.
Michael, that's a very good point, Laura. Michael, let's take those in order. So, Russia, there's this odd sense, isn't there, that the Trump administration, if you look at the generals and the ambassadors and the envoys and the kind of the machinery of government, continues to be pretty hawkish on Russia and to talk about Russia's bad behavior in places like Ukraine, to say that Russia is, you know, trying to interfere in American elections. And then you have a president, Donald Trump, who came to office seeming to think he could cut deals with Vladimir Putin, who's never said a nasty word about Vladimir Putin, calls him, you know, an effective and strong leader. This document, which of those two kind of worldviews about Russia did it reflect, or did it try and kind of straddle those two worldviews?
Well, the thing that was that had the straddling effect was the difference between the document and the speech that introduced the document.
By Donald Trump. So Donald Trump gave a speech
introducing the document. So the document itself, I think, is pretty straightforward about the fact that Russia is a revisionist power, that it threatens the post-World War II order, putting China in the same category, both from a military standpoint and from an economic standpoint, you know, quite importantly. And in the document, it does one important thing, which it admits the meddling of Russia in the democratic elections in the West, all over the world. And this is something that has never come out of the president's mouth, and it did not in the speech introducing the document. He chose not to emphasize that particular thing. So it seems as though if you view the government, the U.S. government, as a ship of state, every sailor on board seems to think that we're headed towards this Russian iceberg, but the captain says there's nothing to see here.
Laura, let's turn to China as well. So there is a sense here in Washington, D.C., of a kind of real backlash against China. You know, there's congressional hearings about maybe the Chinese are trying to infiltrate American universities. There's a lot of concern about Chinese media operating in the U.S. There's a general sense of kind of distrust. Now, this national security strategy, when it turned to China, I mean, for the last 20 or 30 years, American governments of both right and left have said, we welcome China's rise. We hope that if we give them this sort of help and this concession, that they will join us in a kind of international rules-based order. This national security strategy really seemed to kind of challenge that that bet on China becoming one of the club.
Yes, it was. It was tough on China and, you know, viewing it, casting it as a threat to the U.S. national security. You know, that said, if you look at the actions that, you know, how President Trump has governed, you know, he has talked a lot about developing a close relationship with President Xi of China. So he thinks that that's going to get him what he wants. He has also dropped some of the things of American leadership in the Pacific in terms of starters, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we pulled out of. In his recent trip to Asia, the U.S. did not exert the kind of leadership in the area to bolster other countries in challenging China. So I'm not really sure that his presidency is matching what that document said. But yes, you are right that the document was tough and did cast China in a different light.
Tough, Michael, and also kind of pessimistic. I mean, there's this amazing line at the heart of the document where it talked about how previous governments of both parties had hoped that China could be brought into the system, and that had proven to be a kind of completely false hope. But as Laura also correctly says, President Trump has also had this attempt to build a strong relationship because there are things he needs, like help on North Korea. So are we in this sort of situation where basically it's a bleak and pessimistic kind of vision of a nasty, selfish world, and then he's just going to try and operate within that in this very kind of transactional sense? Is that what we...
There's a question about who this document, the audience that this document was actually written towards, because very much of what the president's communication strategy is all about is meant to be for his 30-35% base that he has. And so to strike a strong pose towards China, towards Russia in print. And he again talks about immigration, strong immigration, talks about a strong economy. All these things are part of the whole America First, Make America Great plan that, you know, has been out there since 2015. This is nothing new. But as Laura says, the really interesting thing is to see the not only the contradictions in the stated policies and in the actions. You say you want to project power in Southeast Asia, and you pull out of TPP, which is a projection of power more than anything
else. The giant
else.
Trade pact that was going to bind
exactly.
13 countries it,
it
in
is,
Asia.
It is a complete contradiction. So what it really points up is that the global politics are complicated. These geopolitical structures and the American strategy in particular, as at this point still sort of the leader of how power and safety and this balance of power is going to be maintained in the world. It's a very complicated thing, and the administration seems to want to dumb it down and make it simple and into a series of slogans. And it really just isn't possible to do that in speech or in policy.
That's absolutely right. I remember, I'll indulge myself by quoting my favorite quote on foreign policy from a very bright British diplomat, Sir Robert Cooper, who said, "The problem with foreign policy is it involves foreigners, and they don't always do what you tell them." So let's move to South Africa, where they had a very important internal party election, Laura, which effectively chooses the next president of South Africa because the African National Congress has such a dominant position there. And we had this kind of really, really, really ferocious matchup between Cyril Ramaphosa, former labor union boss, wealthy businessman, who made a lot of his campaign around the fight against really rampant corruption in the South African business political elite. And then you had the sort of the dynasty of the current president, Jacob Zuma, an attempt to continue that dynasty with his ex-wife running for the same job. What was the end result?
Well, the result was that Ramaphosa won. It was a very important result. It was a rejection of Zuma and his leadership and, as you say, the rampant corruption that is going on and the ANC's fortunes, which have dropped in recent years. The black middle class rejecting what he's done. The people who living in the cities not wanting to be part of the ANC, which, of course, is the historic home of Nelson Mandela and who, you know, brought, you know, justice to South Africa. So this is a very important political party, not just your everyday political party. And they were saying essentially, no, the course that you're steering is a wrong one. So the choice of Ramaphosa is also interesting because, you know, he is a business guy. You know, Mandela wanted him to succeed him in the office. That didn't end up happening. He took a different course, opened a bunch of McDonald's, served on corporate boards. Now he's coming back and saying he's going to essentially bring that kind of business-minded sense to the government as a whole. And, you know, I think it's really interesting to see whether he'll be able to turn around the fortunes of both South Africa as well as the ANC.
Michael, it got pretty nasty, and at some points, allies of the current president, Jacob Zuma, were accusing Cyril Ramaphosa of being owned and corrupted by white monopoly capital. But he has some pretty strong kind of credentials within the ANC, no?
Yes, he is trusted. He's considered a wise and shrewd negotiator. He was the lead negotiator for the ANC that unwound the apartheid policy when that was being done during Mandela's term. And as Lloyd says, he was Mandela's choice to be president. Actually, when Thabo Mbeki won, and then in 1996, Ramaphosa goes off to be in business. But he is considered to be a very shrewd man, a trusted person, a trusted commodity by the people in general. Does not mean that he will not face some very serious and fierce infighting within the ANC, because that party has a ruling sort of council of six members, and they are exactly split right now between Zuma loyalists and Ramaphosa people.
And Laura, Jacob Zuma's still quite a lot of time left as president. Right. I think it's more than a year still in office. And, I mean, obviously, a lot of our listeners are very aware of how important South Africa is. But, I mean, here in Washington, do you think people are focused enough on what a big and important economy South Africa is and how potentially unstable the next few months could be?
I think if you ask the question, are people in Washington focused on enough on anything that happens on the continent of Africa, the answer would probably be no. Frankly, there's a lot going on here, and here in D.C., I don't think that most people actually, for better or worse, spend a lot of time thinking about the ramifications of African politics, but that doesn't mean it's not important.
Well, that's a very good point, if slightly depressing. And we will expand on all of this when we come back from a short break.
More of Issues in the News in just a moment. This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. And a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor. Our moderator is David Rennie, Washington bureau chief for The Economist.
So we're living in an age here in the United States where populism is kind of on every political reporter's kind of lips. You know, we're talking about these populist kind of waves in certainly Donald Trump's election. You look at Europe, there are populists either winning in things like Brexit or doing very well. Latin America looks a bit different, Laura. In election after election, people actually choosing centrist and in some cases center-right kind of establishment figures. Chile has just had an election, and the guy who won there is a kind of silver-haired, boardroom-ready kind of billionaire conservative businessman, Sebastian Piñera, who was president before. What is happening in Latin America that's so different from us?
Well, I think part of the explanation is that a lot of more left-wing leaders had been elected in an earlier wave. So I think that may be part of the answer. People looking at economic problems in those countries, there's a lot of it. And so when you have economic strife, you start looking, saying, well, you know, maybe the business guy knows what he's talking about after all.
Michael, it's also very striking, if you do any reporting in Latin America or Central America at the moment, that the example of Venezuela comes up. So you see this happening. There's going to be a big election in Mexico next year, where you have a populist candidate who has a lot of the kind of populist, fiery, kind of class warrior type rhetoric. The single most damaging thing that his opponents have to say about him is, look at what's happening in Venezuela, where left-wing populists are running the economy into the ground. Is that something that you think is true across the whole of Latin America? Could that have played into this Chilean election as well?
It certainly did play into the election. This was a runoff election that Piñera won, and he was facing a group of people who were more left-leaning than him. He's not a right-wing candidate. There was some angst about whether he's a totally right-wing candidate, very strong in that sort of sense, very populist and protectionist type of policy, but he isn't. He's more sort of like the old Republicans in the U.S. used to be, you know, sort of center-ish. But I think what this really points to, this particular election, is the fact that you have sort of a disappearing middle in that country. And it makes it very, very different to govern, just like it does in all situations where you have a distrust of the center of the establishment. That's what you had in this Chile election. And you had the Broad Party that has moved very, very much to the left. You have Piñera, which is more right-leaning. And it's going to be very difficult for him to solve the issues like the national pension, education, these huge issues, privatization of industries. you need to have a broad level of support. You need to have agreement across the middle to do that. And currently there is no middle. So there's some excitement about him now because he is ejecting sort of this corrupt government, as Laura says, that left-leaning swing of the pendulum is sort of swinging back. But still, will he be able to govern? I think it will be very difficult for him to do that.
Laura, in terms of Latin American politics, clearly, you know, in any Latin American election or even any Latin American political debate, there is always an invisible figure in the corner kind of dressed as Uncle Sam, because the United States is such a gigantic kind of political presence in the whole of Latin American politics, just by being the giant kind of gringo neighbor up north. And you can either be pro or anti-American, but America is always in that debate. Is there a sense that politicians are under pressure to stand up to Donald Trump and not be bullied by this kind of textbook villain American president?
Yeah, I'd say that there is. In general, Latin Americans have a lot of them have bad history with the U.S. It's sort of they can't live with us, can't live without us, and don't think that the U.S. has always been a force for good in the hemisphere. So now Donald Trump comes along, who is, you know, with his America First and his border wall with Mexico, his very negative comments about immigration is, you know, there is no love lost there. So to whatever extent there was already anti-American sentiment, I think that he just, you know, turbocharges it.
And Michael, it's an interesting thing. I was in Mexico doing some reporting a few weeks ago where people said that standing up to Donald Trump was an election winner, but being thought to be like Donald Trump is an election loser. And that's another thing that's kind of dragging on populists. Do you think that we're going to see that not just in Latin America, but more broadly, that Trump is having this kind of global effect on kind of angry populists?
I do. I think that people are looking at populism. And we talked about this before, the terms of a populism versus popularity. And then you have people mm-hmm. who are really popular and come into office. But if you're not competent in running government, you're going to fail, regardless of how much red meat you throw out to your base. With the U.S. and the relationship with Chile, the definitive period in that relationship is, of course, the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. Mm-hmm. And we're 27 years past that now. And what no one wants to see is either on the right or the left to return to that sort of authoritarianism, especially not with the complicity of the United States.
Laura, let's finish by looking at what's been happening in Washington, D.C. the last few days. After many, many months of wondering if Republicans were going to be able to pass any of their big legislative ambitions, they finally did do something pretty enormous that is going to have long-lasting effects on the American economy. What did they just pass?
Well, they passed a huge tax cut. It's going to cost the government $1.5 trillion over 10 years. The Republicans believe that it will generate a lot of economic growth and that will make up for some of that, but experts say not all of that. Why did they do it? To try to stimulate the economy even further. The economy is in good shape now, but they'd like it so that the U.S. corporations are not competitive globally. We need to drive down the corporate tax rate. That was a big portion of it, but it also affects individuals. A bit ironically, it's a huge tax cut, but not everybody is getting a tax cut. The way it's written is, you know, it depends that certain deductions are eliminated and others are not. And the result is that kind of depends on where you live, how you're going to fare under this. The bulk of the benefit is delivered to the upper income tax filers. That's partly because they pay most of the taxes. It's also because there are provisions in there that lower their rates and have other elements that particularly affect the wealthy, such as changes to the estate tax. So there is a lot in this bill, but the bottom line is that they believe it will be good for the economy. Democrats believe that is a huge giveaway to the rich. And the question next will be, you know, what's the political ramification of this? They have passed it on with only Republican votes. Not a single Democrat in the House or the Senate supported this. Frankly, it reminds me a lot of the Affordable Care Act passage, because in that case,
otherwise known as Obamacare sometimes.
Sometimes called Obamacare, the big health law, that was passed with only Democratic votes. Democrats pushed that through because they believed in it to their core that it was an important thing to do to provide health insurance. Republicans believe in their core that it is an important thing to provide tax cuts. Now, what we saw with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is that it was very politically unpopular and Democrats paid a price. It's also very difficult to get rid of once you had it. And that may be the same two things may be at work here. We'll see.
Michael, before we look at what the likely politics might be of this, let's just answer one quick question, which is Republicans going into this tax debate, they said what they wanted to do was something which actually mainstream economists would approve of, which is you have this gigantic, you know, American tax code with tens of thousands of rules. You make it much, much simpler. You lower the overall tax rates, but you take away a lot of the kind of special carve-outs and loopholes and you simplify. And they talked about people being able to file their income tax on a postcard. Have they simplified the tax code?
No, I don't think so. There are some benefits that are very simple to understand, but I don't think that the tax cut, this is not tax reform, as Laura said, it's a tax cut. And
that's a good point.
I just want to say that there was a party line vote, yes, with the Affordable Care Act. And there was a party line vote with this particular tax bill, but it differs greatly in the fact that there was almost a year and a half worth of regular order hearings, a testimony from experts that went into the crafting of the Affordable Care Act. Republicans were there every single step of the way for 15 months. This was done with about 16 people, you know, working, and then that group of people going out to their party colleagues saying, what do we need to do to get your votes in? We're going to be finding out over the course of a couple of weeks, actually, what this does. And they want to make this bill, this massive bill that has just administrative ramifications, effective on January 3rd. Well, we start our tax process. You know, nobody knows what your deductions are going to be if this gets signed on January 3rd. All the paperwork has to change. It was done as a political move to give something to the base, to give a win to the president. Whether it turns out to be a win across the board in 2018 really remains to be seen.
And of course, Laura, although clearly every ordinary American who pays taxes is going to be looking at the effect on them, the biggest effect will be on business rates. That was a really big cut, that America had these on paper very high corporate tax rates, although a lot of companies didn't pay the full top rate. Most companies probably didn't. But you have got this big tax cut. Now, the promise from the president and his aides and assistants is that American business will do two great things now. They will bring a whole bunch of money back into the country, which will provide a huge boost to spending. They'll be able to build new factories full of gleaming new machines, and they will give some of that money back to workers in the form of pay rises. Is that what has happened in the past when the corporate tax rate has been cut? I mean, what's the economic record on this promise?
Well, one thing we can say is right now, corporations have a lot of money. Their corporations are not lacking for money, and they have not been using it to give people pay raises. So they've been buying back their stock. They've been
to give basically it makes their stock more valuable for people who are shareholders already.
Exactly. So the investors get a benefit, stockholders get a benefit, but regular people have not. So I don't think the track record is particularly promising to people getting a raise. That is essentially what trickle-down economics is all about, is that eventually you give it to the companies, it will come down in the form, and that has not proven to be the case in the past.
Michael, let's just end by talking about the grubby politics. We're here in Washington. It may be Christmas, but grubby politics is what we do here. Democrats are pretty sure that this is going to be a loser for Republicans, because it's going to be a giveaway to the rich and people will be angry. Republicans are equally clear that they think this is going to be a winner. They think they get to play Santa Claus and they're going to lower people's taxes and it's going to help them win important midterm elections next year. Who's likely to be right? What do we think at the moment?
It depends on what happens next, because we have this $1.5 trillion deficit that's been created. Now, on the one hand, you have Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin giving interviews saying that a 0.1% increase will cover this entire deficit and there's no problem, so there's nothing to see here.
Growth will save us.
Exactly. Growth will save this and wipe this whole thing out. At the same time, you have Paul Ryan making plans to cut Medicare and Medicaid and children's insurance programs to cover the deficit. So it depends on whether the growth happens. If they cut Medicare across the board, if they attempt to do that, it is going to be a huge loser.
So very quickly, Laura, Michael's, I think, suggesting that basically they've blown a hole in the budget. So the next step will be saying, let's make some cuts to benefits for poorer people and sick people.
I doubt it'll be Medicare, which affects middle class people, but Medicaid, which helps the poor, you know, their target is definitely on its back.
Well, that's about all the time we have. And thank you so much to Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor, and to Laura Mechler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. This program was produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief for The Economist. Thanks for listening.